Thanks very much. Can you hear me okay?
You are coming through loud and clear. That's perfect.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so by way of explanation of the title of my book, Nostoc, and so that you don't get the impression that I'm some sort of religious zealot, I just like to point out that it doesn't refer to some Latinate pre-Vatican II doctrine, although I do like those connotations. But it actually refers to a mysterious fungus that comes to the surface after periods of rain, and it has various folk names such as star jelly and witch's butter. The late Victorian era was probably when man first began to attempt to restrain and tame nature. It also coincided with the Anglo-Irish ascendancy class's strange fascination with all things Celtic. At the same time that Maud Gonne was turning up at Irish literary revival events dressed in ancient Celtic costumes that she'd actually designed herself, a certain Captain Graham was obsessed with trying to resurrect the old Irish wolfhound, although it is now scientifically doubted that the breed ever actually existed. These first three pieces are from a short sequence dealing in part with man's meddling with nature's coding. Victorian. Out in his cobbled backyard, the Reverend Jack Russell watches a goldfinch prepare for its own funeral, muted by the stacks of ghost white dog hair that it snatches from the ground. He has been breeding for a few seasons now, miniaturizing at every step, unpacking the Russian doll of a fox hunting dog from each of the discarded ghosts. Every dawn and dusk, he has watched the local foxes steal their red cloven way across the fields, the tinderbox of their nerves scurrying for sanctuary now that the covenant has been betrayed. A fox slid out of the ivy hedging up ahead and stalled to stare at our two dogs, their leads harnessing them to a different world, as a brief flame of sensation shimmered between all three, a flicker of startled memory. Napkins of cloud were dragged through the pewter ring of the moon, napkin tight to napkin of night being hurried through as a mutiny of crows harassed each other through a child's broken drum, and the cot lurched like a ship in the hardening ice. The nursery had been disturbed, and all three had fled their disrupted Eden. One of the dogs came back out of the ditch, head tilted upwards and proudly panting, his mouth stuffed with the ball of a staring rabbit's head, its ears smoothly stiff, a medieval shuttlecock, perfectly and neatly severed, the veins neatly trimmed, as if the fox had just unscrewed and discarded it, like a doll's head of the kind that the same fox had dismantled the winter previous, stealing about the frozen fields in its clothes, the frilled hems being distracted and harassed by every torn hedgerow. Nostoc. The female dog has spent the early part of winter outdoors, licking and chewing witch's butter. The residue of nights of rain and misformed thoughts, a regurgitated language that she refuses to share, dressed as she is in an old gabardine school coat and hair that she will no longer address. Her womb must be squirming with a hatchery of mermaid's purses. It won't be long now before she begins to dribble miniature dogfish, skate, and sharks, all which will bask briefly in the cold light of day, buckling about in a wind as muscular as a Clydesdale. She is wobbled away from countless strokes. Yet, no matter how we try to dress her up, she continues to spill a variety of life forms. Nostrum Nox. Where are you going with that blood on your shirt, boy? The fox asked me. I didn't recognize him at first, being out of the raggedy dress he normally wore. He said that he'd been out helping with the lambing, reddling the frost around the newborns. I told him that there was the womb of a horse lying in our driveway, the Trojan knight having abandoned it there so as to transfer something else. I asked him if he'd anything to help with the loss of an old dog. Maybe the knight will bring her back, boy, the fox said. I used to like to think that I occupied a similar mindscape to the Portuguese artist Paula Rego, some old musty cobwebbed Victorian attic with a big trunk of forgotten costumes and animal skins that we had fun mentally dressing up in. That was before I read an interview that she gave a couple of years back, and I realized that she'd been in the attic for completely different reasons to me. And I remember being bothered for a good few days afterwards for her, thinking about the demons that she'd been disguising herself in order to hide from. On reading that Paula Rego suffered horrifically from depression, I was surprised at how saddened I felt on reading that Paula Rego suffered horrifically from depression, literally crawling away from herself on that couch, and thought about how the mirror of her own hauntings had been hung with black Victorian fabric and the too loud fabric of her own winding sheet, so frightening, like the crinkling of night's dowager hump, its deformed egg of prelight fabricated in the tin pot of a billy in the bowl. The same tin pot that so many of her women, condemned to bleed and endlessly breed, squatted over with their melon-swollen ties. So many spilled rabbit's parts slinking into the hickory-dickory dock as all the mice scurried up around her neck, which at the end of the interview she began to squeeze and squeak, her child's face suddenly revealed again above a necklace of mice that her granddaughter had made for her. The heron figure in this book is a death figure, its wings getting ever louder as the book progresses. The bird itself is probably the perfect embodiment of the phrase cloak and dagger, standing as it does on its solitary watches. And although I'm quite sure that the creature is far more benign in real life, I would still recommend that if a heron were ever to walk up to you and ask you to play a game of cards with it, then I would implore you to just walk away. A heron's possessions. From an old heron lullaby. The hooded winter lured the hooded boys into the hooded river. Crows, hangmen, boatmen. These are the shadows that had been affixed to their hooves while they still lay in their cradles. These are the shadows that trail them on every one of their walks. Sighted in the light of fox equinox, an amber-stained post-storm dawn, with the appearance of wind-blown foam having attached itself to some random sticks, and the notion that there is something darker overcrowding itself within, pushing against a hunch of its back, presiding over an orphanage, afloat with bloated, lifeless fish. It stands at the bend in the river where all the young boys slipped into the water to drown the year all the otters began to die, their dried-out pelts littering the current-piled shore like old bits of bark, and unfolds the lengths of its wings, a pair of Turin shrouds in which the shadow of every swaddled child is still just about visible. Like most small cities, Cork had its well-known suicide spot during the 70s and 80s. It is an old disused railway viaduct that looms over the road to West Cork on the very edge of the city, standing like the ghost gates to the city in a previous century. I pass under that viaduct twice a day, going to and from work, and every so often the light in that dip can seem different from all else around it. Bird movement above the viaduct, N71. We usually come here once a week to clear up the wings and things of all those that failed to fly, their ill-conceived wings, their wing-conceived ills, their plastic bag and sellotape contraptions, their chicken wire and bedsheet fallacies, all those boys and young men that did not want to become those men who spend their Februarys tramping around the fields that surround us, hunting a fox in the sleet, their lives measured in the years of these dog days, their savage need for debt on a Sunday afternoon. Sometimes, on a cold winter morning, the light grows strange, and above the viaduct, a flurry of seagulls begins to snow upwards. Okay, with the English crown coveting his lands, the Irish chieftain O'Sullivan Bear was forced to flee his lands in the winter of 1601, and along with 1,000 of his people, he marched northwards in search of safety and support. The writing duo, Edith Somerville and Violet Ross, now seem to be the last vestiges of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy class, lived on their estate close to the Bera Peninsula. Even after the death of Violet Ross, Edith Somerville continued to publish under their joint names, claiming that the two were still in contact. The bearing of the dead across on the Jersey Island cable car. O'Sullivan Bear, captain of his nation, chief Irish of Ireland, Lord of Bear, of Horse Island, Hog Island, Fort of the Pigs, Pig Moor, of the herds of herring ploughing through those waters as the ocean's temperature rose, their tide dragging with them the spires of Spanish fishing fleets. A lordship defined by the ghost wards that the fish inhabited, bordering the rock that was frozen beneath the moss, beneath the peat, and the rivers that leaked silver and copper through his land. Ghost wards, dense with cod, haddock, salmon and mackerel all through summer, herring and pilchard in autumn, monkfish and plaice all year round, beds of oysters, nets spilling cacophonies of lobster, crabs, mussels and cockles. O'Sullivan, Sylvan in that remote and barbarous country that the crown wanted for its coastal trade, burning the corn of Bantry and Beara, called to the Tower of London in 1589 and 1592, and again in 1593 to resolve dispute after dispute as they continued to survey the region for clearance. And in the mist muttering distance, the incomprehensible dry hark of calling to hound the West Carberry foxhounds from across the snow-smothered estate of Somerville, where a congress of foxes hides beneath the pews of a church as the last shards of winter light that Harry Clark has made literate spells out their mood across the stone-flagged floor. And Violet has taken to dressing like the gardener in an old trench coat, her hair wild and unkempt and frizzing in the constant drizzle. She dismantled the horse car horn from the Daimler. I found it secreted in her coat's bottomless pockets, those tattered pockets that leak constellations that give a midday sheen to the whole white bright pelt of the snow. January comes wearing wolf masks. The trees are garbed in armor and bleed fruits of crow. The shattered sleet breaks through the air and is trampled beneath into frost, the exhausting mush and slush of dragging wrapped ankles and shins that freeze in those rags of frost-flaked, shivering silver. They killed 12 of their own horses, making curraghs from their hides, packing their prepared flesh for meat. North through O'Kelly country, sleet mapped the already dead all the way back to Glengariff, the snow so deep as heavy as dead horses, its weight everywhere, dragging on everything, sleet so vivid and cold like the exposed workings of night, the cold shoals of stars crowding the night, their fires shattering the blackness of the forests, the snow falling to the rhythm of slow bells, the moon's light echoing on its surface where it lies. Poor Violet has caught a severe chill. She just can't seem to warm up. I found her on the grounds, chasing shadows across the snow in her nightings. She says that she saw a procession of about 1,000 bedraggled souls marching beneath the moon. She wanted to help them. She can only stomach porridge, and even that she has a problem trying to keep down. She just can't seem to keep warm. As the Daimler that Edith can no longer afford to pay petrol for sits delicate as a moth beneath frost on the snow outside Somerville House. Inside, the gramophone plays a sad gin-soaked New Year's Eve song for poor Violet, and all the lights in the house have been switched off in a final bid to economize. With a Spanish bell ringing of white pointed hoods and meshed veils of black roses, his death echoed as he was stabbed, and the winter of 1601 once more flowed from his side, along with the trampled footprints of the 965 who carried his blood and the glass altar of his title through the Irish frost and snow and the medieval dying light. And poor Edith, out on the lawn, lost in the centuries old fog, still looking for Violet, and Violet exiled on the moon, unloading the ships, their hulls full of snow and ice. Okay, there's a lot of ghosts in these last two pieces, and although they're not linked in the collection itself, I thought that they'd go well together in a reading. Growing up, I was so used to the words to Mary's that it was only after the book printed that I realized that it seems to be only a Cork word for those small travelling and seasonal funfairs that were such a part of the holiday season in the second half of the last century, with their bright primary colours and innocent mechanics, and which now seem so drenched in the melancholy of nostalgia. One of these, Mary's Piper's Funfair, used to winter across the way from where my father worked in the 70s, all the rides covered in seasonal tarpaulin, waiting for the spring. A reading of Cy Twombly's Leaving Paphos Ringed with Waves. Leaving Blasket and Arran, waves heaped on all sides, the dead stain the sea with their shoals, a wound of boats begins to bleed, our rage has been winged by grief, a blood of orange dripping through the sea, ringed with wings, we rage with grief. And then we went down to the Currachs and watched the hordes of ghosted women in black shawls follow the men off the train from Cork as they trampled through the all sunshine into Clancy's pub, and then peered through a window as homemade dresses twirled over the sliding water lilies of light on the almost empty dance floor of the Strand Palace next door, and then later onto the Moby Dick pub to chase the echo of gaudy swing boats of giddy orange raised against a darkening sky as a shoal of seagulls twisted and turned overhead, gilded silver in the sieved light, and then to be released into the damp July night as the music of the funfairs bled orange in the blue rain, all the way from Perks and Yall to Pipers and Crosshaven, the echo slowly blinking out from Dingle Pier to Lahinch, from Salt Hill to Westport, hives of light strung out all along the coast, with the only music now to be found along the empty shoreline being the low, sad sound of the Merries heard at a distance of ghost cheers. Piper's Funfair, Winter Grounds, Douglas, an echo. Something unseen sparks a slump of seagulls to spin up off the river, with aeroplane screams and rotate as if confined within a wall of debt, as beyond the light, a silt of stars gets pushed out just that little bit further, like a coin pusher machine in an arcade. And then, just as abruptly, like the jellyfish collapse of a big top tent, the seagulls flop and drop to echo out across the river's surface, and the stars remain silted at the edge of the universe as dark's tide is brought to a hushed silence, and it has grown so quiet that you could hear a planet drop. Thanks very much.